Hello and welcome to Promenade Culture Center. This is Culture Corner. We bring you the authentic stories of creative individuals. We're very pleased to host today with us Sara Abdallah, architect and entrepreneur, as well as an instructor in one of Promenade Culture Center programs. Sara, warm welcome to Culture Corner.
Hi, Xenia.
Welcome again to Promenade Culture Center, but the first time in Culture Corner.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, to be honest.
I am so glad we managed to get some time during your visit to Promenade Culture Center and quit. I did not mention that actually you are our first foreign guest in terms of not continuously living in Kuwait, which is extra pleasure because you got some time for us today.
I really feel special now, mm-hmm. even more.
We were just mentioning these past days during the workshop that you're holding, about which we'll talk a bit later, how we actually mentioned you in our very first podcast. We did a little shout out with Mishari Al-Najjar, your partner in narrative, one of our topics. But before we get to that, on how we met and how we collaborate together, I wanted to see with you some of the remarkable things that you are doing and incredible projects you've been conducting. But it all starts somehow with architecture. And we've had a lot of architects on our podcast who are doing either architecture or other things. So it seems to be an incredibly creative milieu. And I wanted to see, what was your story? How did you decide to do it? And were you supported by your education, like the elementary school and high school or family? How did you find out you want to be something like that?
Okay, my story with architecture is actually a very interesting one. And it's something that I did not, it took me by surprise. Mm. So it started off, it didn't start as early as elementary. I remember at one point I wanted to do, I think around 14 years old, maybe. I remember wanting to doing law. I wanted to do law. But that quickly changed. And I was very invested in a lot of things that were happening around. I was invested in some issues, global issues. So I really felt like I wanted to like have my say and contribute positively. Anyways, that was also around the time where I started to understand and really dissect who I was and my kind of personality and whether my personality was fit for what law required of me or whatever discipline required of me. Mm-hmm. And I remember having this conversation, I think, with my father initially when I said, I'm thinking of studying law. And he gave me that other aspect of there's the profession, but there's also character that goes with it. And you'd have to cross-check with yourself whether those two things align. And I think that was the first time that I actually thought, okay, does character fit with that? So then I thought, okay, character, interests. And I was really interested within the creative field. It was one of the things that was really nurtured when I was a child as well. And slowly I was introduced to architecture. I think very indirectly, my brother was had studied engineering earlier on, civil engineering, but for me it was very, very rigid. So I was kind of like picking up on all sorts of experiences from home. And then I started to also speak to people in school. And finally, I just thought that architecture was a right fit. Mm-hmm. It was a fit where it kind of brought in, and at the time I didn't realize how much it honed in, and I think we're gonna tap into that later. But I really felt like it brought in the creative side of me. Mm-hmm. There was a part that was really tangible as well that I wanted to tap into. And that's how I kind of quickly kind of nurtured it up to when I was about 16, when I was ready to apply for universities. Mm-hmm. And I was like set. The moment I had architecture in mind, that was it. There wasn't like a lot of left and right with that decision.
By that time, you were based in Bahrain.
Yes.
So this extremely unique island, this crossroads of so many civilizations, what kind of influence did that have on what we call a cultural identity? We talk a lot about identities here on the podcast, on how much the cultural identity is what we all believe in, regardless of our other identities. How much it influenced your cultural side? And then how much of a cultural shock you might have had or not have had once you left for university?
So Bahrain is really unique. Mm. It's really unique in a way that it is like for such a small island, it's so dense with so many different cultures. It's a mishmash of a lot of things. Mm. One, because where it is geographically, two, because it's an island, it was a port for everyone. And usually islands have that about them. They're really, really multicultural. So as diverse as it was, and I think that really contributes to a lot of cultural tolerance as well, because you, as different as everyone was, I think at one point where you, it's only afterwards where you realize the differences. So we're very, very different, but you don't realize it. So the cultural identity part only comes later. Once I was in a broader cultural context. So I didn't realize how diverse it was, but it really contributed. And as much as I was getting older, it started to contribute to my cultural identity. So I only realized this after I left my bubble. So I went to the UK to study architecture. I was in Manchester. And it was only then when I realized, oh, this is diverse. So I really thought that Bahrain, we were all the same. And the kind of the, I was in a bubble within a bubble within a bubble. So then I leave this huge, this world of mine, and I enter something much larger. And you get to, like, Manchester is also very, very multicultural as well, out of a lot of cities in the UK.
And industrial, right? Which kind of in history brought, different people there.
So that's when I started to reflect back on my cultural identity, because it was one of those things where it was a given, because back home, almost everyone, I saw that everyone was the same and it was a given. This is the way they behave. This is culture, until you start forming that identity when you're taken out of it, because now you're out of context. So then who am I? What do I stand for? What are my values? What is my cultural identity? Not just cultural identity, every single identity. And that kind of check with myself continued up to very recently. I think I do these checks more now than I used to.
Comes with age as well.
It really comes with age. It really comes with age. So it's, there wasn't much of a cultural shock. But I went with a lot of curiosity. So there was a lot of, oh, this is, you know, this is different. This is exciting.
A lot of openness comes with curiosity.
And I think the background that I was in as well, that we, although I say we were in a, I was in a bubble, even with school and my surroundings, but we were all quite multicultural as well. And our family was quite open, and we traveled, and we had a lot of international friends and things like that. So we were really exposed. So when I was there, it was, now I can really tap into this.
Those years of studying architecture, how much of it was, wow, this is exactly where I want to be? And how much of it was, this is not what I want to do? Because I think it comes with anything we study, even the things we're most passionate for. And what specific skills did you gain that you still use?
Oh, so this is when I say that it's really interesting. So I started for my bachelor's. I really felt this is exactly where I want to be, because it brought in, I knew how to understand. I loved how the program was structured as well, because there was the design and creative part, which I thrived in and I loved. There was the more rigid construction part of, you know, the things that you have to understand. But then there was the architectural psychology part, and then the history, the architectural history. So the way that this was, the way that the program was structured really gave me that skill to separate and dissect what architecture was. It is also a mishmash of things. It's not just the creative side. It's, you'd have to understand people. You'd have to understand structure. You'd have to understand the history as well. And that's one of the skills of separating, is what I understood. Another thing was understanding how multidisciplinary it was. That caught me by surprise. That was, I think, the biggest surprise for me, because I thought that I was going to go and I was going to be designing buildings and physical structures. So in that way, I was exactly where I wanted to be. But then it really caught me by surprise, which is, you know, turned out where I am now.
Not a bad thing, though. I wanted also to ask you about the experience, and given your curiosity, the experiences of living abroad at a very young age. How much does that shape a person and a person's academic and, like, life path?
In every single way. Mm. So I went when I was 17, so I was pretty young.
Yeah.
And I did go with a very kind of, you know, I was very focused. I was less playful than I am now. Mm-hmm. That also comes with age. I think play came with age for me. Did it on the reverse.
That's very good.
But it was, it really does shape so much. I went with that curiosity, and there was a lot of things that I was within. I think most of my experience abroad was about life rather than my degree. Mm-hmm. And what I studied. And I say that to a lot of people as well. I think studying abroad isn't abroad from home, wherever mm-hmm. home is, not necessarily where Bahrain or Kuwait or wherever, but being kind of, you know, you almost unplug yourself from this mm-hmm. matrix, right? Yeah. And then you get to experience different things. And the living part and the growing, the development, that's what really fed into me. And that went back to academically, mm-hmm. how I was curious about how I actually wanted to take on architecture.
Mm.
Because architecture as a discipline is, as much as it's creative and everything, it's also rigid.
Mm.
The way the architecture schools globally, there's a certain, it's almost like a school of thought
mm-hmm.
that you have to follow certain things. And then you seldom get to like color outside the lines. And yeah. I think that curiosity, the living, being abroad, being exposed, and that's opened the doors to traveling as well. I think we're going to tap into that a little mm-hmm. bit later. That's all fed back into architecture and what I studied. Mm. So I think studying abroad really opened so many doors in terms of my own growth and development, my understanding of cultural identity, my understanding of where I stand, and it gave me definition for a lot of things around me, and I think it's probably the best decision, one of the best decisions I've made. Mm.
We will talk about different creative sides of your persona, but I'd like us to talk about the first creative projects, if you remember them, or the first creative, artistic, entrepreneurial things you did that you can remember and identify as maybe the first or the beginnings of where you are today. Was that in childhood, or did it come later? Was it related to arts, or was it like a community thing? I don't want to talk a lot about everything you do as we will go along this conversation about that, but just to kind of start and see, we realized talking to people that a lot of this creativity came instinctively at first,
mm.
but with some support, whereas it was, a supportive parent or a supportive teacher or just a friend, with that support, it kind of pushed you through pushed people through in their creativity. Can you remember some of your first things you did on your own?
Yeah, I can remember two really distinct ones. Mm-hmm. And this was when I was back in primary school.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many that each one sparks something else. But there was one, I used to love to draw and I used to love to write.
Mm-hmm.
I was really expressive with my writing. My mother was an academic, so she really influenced that. So she was all about reading and writing and expressing and all of that. So I remember her encouraging me. I was writing a story. We talked about stories yeah. before. So I was writing a story, and it was on my, and my, you know, when I'm home and I'm kind of, you know, doing my own thing, this was back in primary school. And she said, you know, Sara, this is actually really, really good. Mm. Why don't we make a book out of it?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, this is how we're going to structure the pages, and we're going to start illustrating this. So let's think of scenes and I'll help you illustrate it. And we actually created this full book. I learned how to bind, and she illustrated the book for me.
Mm.
But we kind of captured it into scenes. And it was the first time when something, you know, I saw this, like it was really simply bound, but this was something that I've made, and it's real and it can go out in the world. And
yeah. Came to life.
It came to life. Mm. And that was just, for me, it was, oh my God, wow. This was like so much bigger than I was. I think I was 7.
Mm.
So it was that thing of writing, creativity, bringing something to life, making it more tangible. I think that whole process for me was super interesting. And there was another one that was also influenced by my father. I remember coming back one day and there was, if I'm not mistaken, I think this was, I think I was 10. There was the, there was a war in Kosovo, I think. And there was a lot of campaigning and things with the school, and the school was really pushing that awareness. And I remember that they wanted us to be involved in some sort of campaign or to create a campaign. And I remember going back home and I said, what am I going to do? And I remember that I said, this has to be creative. This has to be artistic. And I need to communicate to people in a way that they will engage. And I remember working on these posters and making them all colorful and illustrating them and everything. And I remember my father was with me as well. And he said, "Are you? What are you trying to do with this campaign? And are you leading this campaign? Are you following a narrative?" And again, that kind of broader outlook on how creativity can actually make a difference or bring something out there.
Through advocacy.
Yeah. So those are the two really, really early projects I remember.
Yeah. But that have left, you know, left you with a strong impact and influenced probably the things that came afterwards. I'd like us to go back to Sarah finishing architecture and graduating, and then what happens?
Okay, there was something that's quite interesting. There was a coin drop for me right before graduation. So I'll take you like half a step back.
Please do.
We had, in our final year, we had the freedom to, we had a project to create and we had the freedom to do it anywhere in the world. I recall thinking of either China or South Korea. I remember those were the two first countries that came to mind. I can't recall now. China, I think, because the Olympics was there around that time. So we decided to, me and my friend of mine, we decided to go there. And the project was architectural, but non-architectural at the same time. It really tapped into the architectural psychology. So I was really interested in public spaces and how we can influence movement and behavior through very, very simple means. And there was, and I think I did it unintentionally, but I recall saying to Farah, a very close friend of mine, I said, listen, there's this square, this Tiananmen Square, which is the main public square, and it holds about a million people, which is at the time more than the Bahraini population, I think. So it's huge. And they had a march every hour almost, I think, or something like that. And what we did was we got these two huge stuffed toys and we placed them in like the middle of the square. And we just wanted to observe how people would interact. It was so simple. And I think I just wanted to people watch how many people interacted, how many people decided not to. And then the march, it just so happened that we placed them almost in line with where the march was by accident. And you know how these marches are very, very rigid. And we caught like, you know, the army men kind of looking and thinking, you know, and I thought, gosh, the scale and impact. And I thought, this is the side of architecture that I'm actually interested in. It's human behavior rather and what we can do with spaces rather than the confinements of the space itself. So I leave architecture school. I finish. I do my year because we were a year of internship. And then I go back to doing my master's in project management back to Manchester, which was a little bit... I started to realize that I didn't want to fully be engrossed within architecture. I wanted like a more broader look. I wanted to kind of still curious what I could do with it. So I finished, went back to Manchester, did project management, took me off on a tangent. That's where my tangent started. I don't know. I can go on and on and on. So you need to like let me know.
No. You are covering some of the things that I had in mind because I was very curious in that. I'll give you some time to have some coffee.
Okay,
I want to mention that Sarah made some beautiful coffee for us. So I am interested in that relationship between practical and theoretical, also I wanted to ask about some of the interesting projects that you have conducted that are related directly to architecture, although you've now mentioned this beautiful, interesting experiment you've conducted, and also conducting it in such a place. So I'm somewhat older, and for us, the mention of Tiananmen Square is always absolute horror. And it's so interesting to now, I'm now making new connections in my mind with your experiment and thinking of it differently. It almost means something different to me now. It's really incredible how mind works and how the space actually can be seen from a completely different perspective. I am interested if you're happy to share some of the interesting projects you've done that are related to architecture in those first early years, or related to whatever you were doing, understanding that your path will not be of a typical architect, practicing architect. And also, I am curious to know, since you're an avid traveler and we talk about it more, what structures, buildings, places have fascinated you when traveling and why? So a couple of questions, but you can choose really whatever you like.
So let's go back to the first one now. So there's so many things in my mind. Okay, so first we were talking about the prominence projects. Prominence projects I've worked on, I think they were all within injecting kind of soul and understanding spaces as living vessels. And that's what I really wanted to work towards. So in earlier in my career, I worked on commercial buildings, headquarters, university campus. Afterwards, I diverted into, which I still do, which is higher education consultancy. So that was kind of in between. And then I went back into really going into architecture again. And I went into project management and for a real estate development company. And it was activating a long stretch of a public beach. So that had a bit of architecture, project management, going into the details of it, which was very, very interesting. Again, I always try to be involved in things where I can actually influence people's lives and the way that they behaved. So those were kind of the, I mean, they set the foundation. So those were the early ones that set the foundation, because I think you'd have to, no matter how much I wanted to tap into people's behavior, but you really need to understand the foundations of architecture in order to be able to understand people's behavior. So I had to go through all of the draftsman work and the drawings and all of those things, which I find now quite dry for my liking. Not everyone feels the same, but for my liking, I find it a little bit dry. And to be honest, I kind of almost distanced myself from it, because then I started to realize. And back when in university, I recall people dropping out of architecture and thinking, oh, that's not for me. And for me, I just thought, how? Like, there's a sequence and a structure that we should follow. How do you just change your mind? It was like I did not comprehend it. Now, obviously, it's a completely different story. So I went into that, and then I kind of was very, after that, I was quite selective with what I wanted to work on. I was really interested in reviving kind of historical buildings and reviving historical places, which is still at the heart of what I'm interested in. Primarily, for example, in Imharag, the old city in Bahrain. So that's one of the things that it's that revival and still bringing revival, renovation, and injecting soul into things that once was. Which brings me to your next question of, with traveling, what kind of really draws me into them? Cities with scale. That make me aware of my human scale. And I realized that when I started to work on smaller projects in Imharag, which is very human scale. The most you'd find is a two-story building, and these are buildings that were all built around the 20s and 30s. So it's very traditional Bahraini architecture, but you have a sense of scale in terms of buildings, openings, roads and alleyways. And I realized every time I traveled, that's what like drew me in. Like I was never drawn to cities. And it was things that you can have that because the moments that you feel scaled, the place is more approachable. There's more intimacy. People interact differently as well because you just feel like you belong. You feel like this place is for you. One of the places that I can recall was in Brazil, in Parachi. This was 2 years ago, I think. I did a bit of traveling around Brazil, and that's one of the places that really, really drew me in because everything was one or two stories high. Gaul in Sri Lanka, very quite colonial, very multicultural. There was a bit of Portuguese influence, a bit of Sri Lankan influence, but again, it's scale. And also cities that work. So I've been doing a bit of traveling in Scandinavian countries and they just work where they're actually made for humans. I think that we've distanced ourselves. And
incredibly well aligned with nature.
Yes, that too. 100%. Where it's not obtrusive. A lot of how I understand architecture is that it shouldn't be obtrusive. I mean, it's nice for things to make statements. I mean, there are a lot of brutalist buildings here in Kuwait, for example, which I think are marvelous. Very obtrusive, but still, okay, they'd make a statement. But would this place make me belong?
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah, no, it's intimidating almost.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, this was a beautiful piece of what you told us. Thank you so much for sharing. I'm wondering, how do you feel? Of course, we don't have so much time to speak about the future of architecture regionally or locally or globally. But where are we now with architecture? And I'm not talking about styles or, you know, schools of architecture, more like in human terms. How do you feel? Oh. Are you happy with where we are? Could things be better?
100%. Yeah. 100%. I know that throughout architecture school and up to now, I still hear about this pedestrianizing our cities and bringing in, and by our cities, I mean our region. I'm distanced from any other city. And it's just like this, I think we're really trying to reverse back of, okay, we need to get pedestrians in, or we need to kind of have more public spaces. And I've like, my ears bleed now when I listen to these things. So for me, I think whether we're there architecturally, whether I've also kind of detached from that, I think I was really invested in where architecture was taking us and how can we kind of, and I became totally detached because I think we've got it all wrong in a lot of things. I think this cities have become cities. They've been so detached from nature as well. And I think that it's unnatural for humans to be so distanced from nature. And I think architecture plays such a huge role in that distance. I think that we're so, I'm not saying that we should go back to living in huts and things like that. No, but it's actually being harmonious, our spaces. I mean, we visited Hassawi residential complex yesterday. As large as it was, and I think that there was a lot of potential for it to integrate, but there was a lot of, there was interaction with indoor and outdoor. If there was a bit of greenery, then you can kind of feel a little bit at ease. There's a bit of movement. There's, and it didn't seem obtrusive as large as the complex was. Yeah. There was a play with scale as well. And I think that's the kind of thing that we should actually be looking at. So the future of architecture, I mean, I'm not one to say, but am I happy with where it's going? I can foresee a very like unhappy future and a very near future. Because I think we've just expanding into the built environment and built environment means wiping out and building as opposed to a collective built environment that is integrative. So that's my little
we stay piece. Hopeful. Some years ago, I remember that a little building opposite from the building I lived in here in Kuwait was demolished. And my husband believed they were building a park. What a beautiful thought. Of course, no. Another very similar building was erected. And there were days and times where I felt I'll just go into a wrong building one day. They all literally seemed the same. But we'll talk more about some of these things. I want to talk about some of the things you do currently, some of the projects you're invested in, because I think this will give us a glimpse of your careers, not just one career, and multiple hobbies and interests that you have. And this podcast is very much about inspiring people. So inspiring stories come from sometimes unexpected places. And I think your life stories is full of inspiration. So what are you currently engaged with, or where is your passion at this moment?
So I'll tell you where I'm engaged in, because it's still defining passion.
Okay.
It's still defining passion. So currently,
this prolongs youth.
Yeah, probably.
I like that. Yeah.
Probably, because I think passion, once you decide what it is, it's like, that's the destination. Yeah. And I think we're constantly evolving. I think 90% of the things I planned for in life didn't really materialize. They turned out better.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of God's plan kind of thing. So that's my spiritual side. So I'm engaged with a lot of things that also were quite unexpected. I don't think that if you were to ask me 15 years ago, would I ever imagine doing the things that I'm doing? Absolutely not. So while I was in... working for a real estate development company, I was really interested in really like kind of injecting. So I felt like I had more to give to the creative industry rather than just architecture. And for me, architecture is really not about one thing. It's really multifaceted. So I went into creating with a partner of mine. Sadly, he passed away shortly after we started the business. It's Dust for Experience Design, and we really wanted to hone in everything that's created an experience. Would that be architecture? Is it visual? Is it you know, storytelling? What is it? Whatever that goes into creating an experience. And we started off with a very interesting project within the Purling Path, which is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Bahrain, and injecting soul into places like that. So Dust is a little bit of design, experience design. There's storytelling involved. There's curating as well. We've most recently curated the Bahrain Pavilion in the Expo Osaka 2025. We've curated the gift shop as well. So we go into products and things like that. So that's experience. At the heart of what I do and what really made me understand architecture even more is education consultancy. So it's a family business that my mom actually started, and she's very passionate about it. And I think she's really rubbed off that passion on me. So I do that so that there's a lot of career finding and wayfinding for people that have just are approaching university or approaching higher education, and even at a later stage of post degree programs. And I've been through such a journey, and I feel like if I were told a lot of things that I've learned now early on, I think I would have a different take on life. And that's a kind of message that I try to give on when I'm doing those one-to-one consultations. So
that's
education,
so valuable.
Yeah, so it is because I think we're all kind of, for the longest time, we're told exactly what to do and what to study and when we need to raise our hands to do this. And then at 17, you're almost like, did you decide what you want to do for the rest of your life? And I just think, well, we were never taught how to make decisions in the first place for the first 17 years of our lives.
And it's still like that. I mean, I have a 17-year-old kid, so...
And so, absolutely. I mean, we talked a little bit about it. So it's educating not only students, but the parents as well, on, because you're talking about generational differences that you can make, obviously, from my little corner of the office, trying to like make those changes. So education consultancy is the second. I opened Qartas, which is it started off as a stationery and concept store, but we really went into a lot of B2B, so business to business, where we've customized a lot of things. And for me, that was a way to tell stories of brands. And by brand, I mean, not a brand, an entity, whatever it is. It could be a culture, it could be a brand, whatever. Everyone has a story to tell. But to do it through very subtle and simple products. So how do you communicate culture to someone that isn't really interested in culture? So it's very subtle ways of communication. And maybe, you know, a notebook is a hook. And then they'd probably, you know, maybe flip over and think, oh, this is actually interesting. So something like that. And my latest venture, so I was obsessed with education from then. It was paper and products and design, which brought me into my latest venture, which is 4-month-old baby now, which is called Bread and Paper. So it's a bakery that I feel ties in a lot of things. So I have it with a partner of mine. He's a chef, Yusuf Gembar. And we always say that he's the bread and I'm the paper. So he's the chef and, you know, the creative behind the food. And I'm kind of the creative behind the actual concept. And it is, we've opened it on the Purling Path, which is like a little hole in the wall. And we're, you know, we're, it's one of those things where we kind of communicate culture through bread.
My heart is singing right now. We did talk that I like to bake and I was involved in some projects that are food as cultural heritage. And what you're saying right now really speaks to me.
And yeah, and you, I mean, beautiful. you mentioned that as well earlier when we were talking about food really communicates a lot of things.
Yes. No, it's completely embedded in who we are. And I think these places like Bahrain or like other places that have seen a lot of different nations come, you know, pass by, stay, civilizations clash, is all reflected in food. And in the ways we consume food and we in the ways we decorate it, in the ways we cook it. And I am so happy for this. It's on my list. I'm visiting for sure.
You are. End of the year.
Yes.
End of the year.
Hopefully it's a plan and now it's officially on air. When we speak about partnerships that you have, these valuable partnerships you've mentioned for opening some of your businesses, I'd like us to mention the Innarrative platform, which we've actually already mentioned before with Mishari Al-Najjar, architect and artist, whom we've interviewed here and who is a dear friend. I think I am mesmerized with the way how you function and how Innarrative grows and shifts and changes. And we did ask Mishari about it, but we want your take on the platform as well. How did it come to life? And what do you do? What is it?
One of my most favorite, and I'm not saying this because Mishari is like right outside the door, but it came out of a frustration, to be honest. This was back in 2017. It came out of a frustration of quite a lot of things, but it all revolved around architecture. There was a rigidity to architecture that we still see. We started to realize that, you know, architecture was, you know, I keep saying this, that it's much more than the actual discipline. And it's about time that we understand the stories and how we influence architecture as people. And it's a huge discipline that it's not tapped into. So it came out of a frustration of that. And a lot of what we do starts with, can we talk? Are you free? Because I'm based in Bahrain. Mishari is based in Kuwait, a very, very good friend of mine, a very close friend of mine. So, and we just thought, you know what, this is going to be, you know, we might as well start it. And it's almost like a platform. It's a multidisciplinary platform. It brings in architecture and storytelling. And then it kind of taps into a lot of other things and skills and block printing and textiles and all of that, because I think a lot of what we do outside of a narrative pours into it as well. And to be honest, it gives us the room to play. The structure is not very structured and rigid as everything else that we do outside of a narrative. And it allows other people as well to play. And I think the one of the, for me, the most thing, one of the most things that I pride myself with in with a narrative is that we get such diverse people coming into our workshops that have absolutely nothing to do with design or architecture. And that was the goal. It was to reach out to non-architects and non-designers and have them a part of the architecture conversation.
Everything is better with storytelling as well.
100%.
So you do different workshops in various different places. I've been following the work, but for Prominent Culture Center, we're working specifically, I'm just reminding our audience, on Havali Cultural Map, where we have decided to, in this concrete jungle, pinpoint and select certain buildings of historical heritage community importance, and then reimagine them in a certain way, in a nutshell. Mm. So we've done a number of buildings over the years, and we've seen, like you've said, a number of very different individuals being involved, some with some expertise, some not. More of not having any experience or connection to architecture. You seem to be at home when you do this in Kuwait. So I'm not a local. Well, I am now in a way, but I'm a foreigner. So, but in my eye, and from my standing point, you seem to be very much as if you've been here your whole life. How do you manage that? Is it your connection to structures and your great, great partnership and friendship with Mishari in your work, the shared perspective? Is it the love of documenting and storytelling, the curiosity in who these people are who come to your workshops? Because it feels like you could be anywhere in the world and you could still be very local, seem like a local person. I think that's a beautiful quality.
I think you said it's better than I would ever say, to be honest, because it is a collection of all of those things. Mm. To be honest, Mishari, I don't know actually whether I've actually told, I think I have told him this, but I'm going to remind him again. He plays such a huge role in the way that I, in my role in narrative and in the city in Kuwait. Because I think that when we've done workshops in Bahrain, he is very local to that as well. Mm-hmm. And even though it's been a while back, it's been a few years since we've done one in Bahrain. But the way that he kind of really, he really approaches it with grace, and I learn a lot from him. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also, yeah, there's that curiosity and that it's, you know, when you start things with a beginner's mindset. Mm. And I think that's even more interesting than knowing the place because you have preset judgments. So I think that works even better for me because you see it with a fresh set of eyes. And I think that it's more relatable to the people that join our workshops as well, because they're seeing it for the first time rather than coming with prejudgments and set kind of judgments on what the turnout should be. So, yeah, I think it's a bit of it's a lot of Mishari and it's a bit of curiosity.
We hope we will continue to work with you in this way or the other as the demand goes for within our programs. Is there any other things you're planning for in narrative sooner or later?
I think it's, to be honest, because a narrative is so like serendipitous, I think. Mm-hmm. So there was never like a really like...
A plan definitive. And a structure, yeah.
But there's actually a piece of work that me and Mishari have been wanting to work on for a while that has to do with buildings and textiles. And there was one of the projects that never really materialized. I don't know whether he spoke about it or not, but it was Al-Kuwaitiya and Al-Kuwaiti building. Mm-hmm. So Al-Kuwaiti building in Bahrain and Al-Kuwaitiya, which was...
I think we didn't mention this.
Okay, so this was... So we realized a couple of years ago that there was a project. There were two buildings, Al-Kuwaiti building, who was owned by Al-Kuwaiti in Bahrain. And it was just because it was so prominent in Bahrain, everyone knew that was the Kuwaiti building.
Okay.
And then there's the Al-Kuwaitiya, which was here, which was now demolished. And there was a piece of work where we wanted to create this dialogue between two, because now they're both demolished. And this was, they're quite same, but different. And then we wanted to create this dialogue of buildings being demolished and should they be or shouldn't they be? And, you know, that kind of dialogue and kind of bring it in within textiles. So I think that's probably one of the things that I'd really like to do after this. And obviously, like, I hope that we continue to work together as well, because this has been so interesting.
Now we'll jump to your travels.
Okay.
I'm hoping you'd be happy to share with us. I know you travel a lot, but you don't travel like a regular, dull traveler.
Mm.
from my perspective, you choose interesting places. You travel in a group a lot, right? So it seems like there's this shared interest and passion between people to visit some places that demand strength and skill. You've climbed some crazy mountains. You've been to some very distant places. Traveling is beautiful. It also takes a lot from us in terms of energy and, you know, planning. How do you find time? How do you choose where you go? What do you get out of this?
This is probably one of the best parts of my life, mm-hmm. is to be able to travel. And it goes back to, again, that curiosity, mm-hmm. And always take the road less traveled by, mm-hmm. always. Finding the time, I think it's just like we find the time to, if we want to get fit, we find the time, mm-hmm. to go to the gym. It becomes a non-negotiable when it's a priority. Finding the time to, I don't know, have 3 meals a day. Mm. It's a non-negotiable. It's almost set that I have to have my breakfast, my lunch, and my dinner. It's not something. So traveling for me is one of those things. And it's not necessarily just with, so I managed to travel with a group of people I know and groups of people I don't know.
Mm.
And I make the time to travel solo as well. Completely solo, and that's where my kind of identity, cultural, mm-hmm. or I do an identity audit when I travel solo and in places where I just drop myself in and I just think, you know, who are you when you're completely detached from your familiar surroundings? So it becomes a non-negotiable. I think people look at traveling a lot, and I've been told this as well, as, you know, you're traveling all the time, and it's always like there's like this negative connotation, mm-hmm. to a traveler is always like jumping from one thing to another. And actually traveling is what grounds me, because
mm-hmm.
I don't think that we should be rooted in one place all the time. Traveling gives us perspective on our scale, where mm-hmm. we fall, because I really feel that sometimes we get so engrossed in our surroundings, mm-hmm. and we feel like we're so deep in that. It's very hard for us to kind of come out of this limited confinement of our comprehension. And when I travel, that kind of breaks those boundaries. And then I come back and start building those walls again. And I travel and that feeds into my work.
Mm.
So that's where my inspiration comes from. It gives me sense of scale. It gives me sense of identity. I think that the world is a huge place made for us to explore. Yeah. And it gives you this life. Mm. So I think it's never really about cities. I mean, cities, if I wanted to understand how a city works and people's mentalities as well. But I think cities have become so generic,
mm.
that you'd find a lot of things. So it's usually traveling to nature.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned, you know, really like mountains and things. So I really go on some difficult expeditions. So Mount Kilimanjaro, for example, is one of my favorites. Mm. So I've summited 3 times now, and every time I went, it was a time to reflect and understand my boundaries or redefine them. So yeah, so traveling becomes a non-negotiable. Just like you have to have your meals, you have to make the time to travel.
Like that. This goes nicely with what I wanted to ask you about. How do you energize and how do you rest? Mm. Over the time, this question, a lot of people have post-show complained to me, like, this is a difficult question, Ksenia. We don't know how we rest.
Mm.
But this is the place where we find our new creative source and strength. At least for me, it is. I have to get away from the computer, the projects, the everyday mundane things to be able to create from scratch again. So I guess your travels do provide that, even though they're very active. What are the other things you do to find rest and recuperation? And do you believe in balance, like balancing different things in life in that way?
I'm going to have a philosophical answer to the balance part, but first I'll tell you about resting. So if I were to, there are 3 main things that I would think of if I were to say rest. One is tapping into a state of mind, because I think a lot of agitation and non-rest comes from our state of mind. So, and I usually go back to like this, you know, like a state of mind where I was at in a certain place. And a lot of it is when I'm traveling. So how do I have that travel state of mind? And when we travel, we feel free, right? There's like a sense of weight lifted off our, and it's a state of mind. So then how do I bring that state of mind here? And two, if I were reading and writing, plays such a huge role in how I kind of collect my thoughts and absorb. And like, imagine if you're on the moon and everything is kind of like floating. So when I'm reading and writing it, I almost bring everything down to earth and just have it kind of organized and grounded. And traveling to rest, rest a certain part. So the part of me that's rushing, the part of me that's trying to meet deadlines, the part of me that's working, I'd be resting that part of my mind when I'm traveling and hiking and camping, for example. So I don't necessarily need to fully rest. So it's just activating different parts of my mind. So, and I think I feel when I haven't rested, when I haven't had the time, when I'm too tired and I haven't had the time to read three, 4 days in a row, or I haven't had the time to write, because writing gives me a way to understand.
It's incredible how we feel it. I feel like I didn't eat almost if I didn't read in a few days. Or like there's like a heavy rock on my chest. Like you are reminded, your body reminds you that you forgot about that important part, at least for me.
100%.
Yeah.
So balance. I mean, a lot of people talk about balance.
I'm specifically asking about balance because I don't believe in it. But I do believe in finding time purposely and with meaning to do things that are not our work, because we are not our work, no matter how much of us is in it. And then finding time for things that really, really make us happy.
That's really nice. Finding time to purposely. What did you say? That was a really nice one. I'm going to use that.
Purposely and with meaning. Decide that certain things are not what makes us. Like for instance, we put so much in our work, but we are not our work. So finding time to do things that make me happy are important for me. And I think threading lightly as well. Now I'm sharing my thoughts on balance.
Sure, of course.
And also those really simple moments that get lost and forgotten, that used to be so much part of our lives, and then somehow they got lost. In my case, it's also there's work, there's family, there's a lot of work around the kids, because kids and parenting is not just feeding them or taking them somewhere, you know, driving them around, but also so much of emotional engagement and understanding who they are and always keeping that emotional presence for them, which is very draining in times. So I think finding those very simple moments, like visiting my kid's cafe, which she has built in her room, you know, or just sitting with myself, going through old photos, reading, you know, things that truly make me happy. I like to sit in a specific position on bed when I read and so on. And if I sit differently, that's not it, you know.
Yeah.
So these things, these incredibly simple things that really make me happy, or, you know.
I think that's super interesting that you said, and you're 100% on point. So there are two things that I wanted to share about balance. I 100% agree with you that I don't necessarily believe in balance either, because finding the time and making the time, and some things got to give. There was a time that I was training for... I was a triathlete, so I was training as a triathlete, and I was training for the Ironman. And at the time, that was my obsession. I obsessed about it. Now, if you wanted to train on such a rigorous sport, you really had to give up on things. So if I had to wake up at 4 a.m. every day and train twice a day every day and make sure that I sleep enough, but when I'm sleeping, my mind is at rest as well, so my body can recover, all of these things, something has to drop out. And what dropped out, for example, at the time was my social life.
Yeah.
Because by 8 p.m., I was like done. And by 9 p.m., I wanted to be in bed so I can start the cycle again by 4. So was my life balanced? It was balanced for me because I had a goal. And that's what I wanted to do. Did I have to compromise on something? Yes, I compromised on my social life for a chunk of time. And even my maybe my presence with my family as well, because I was just tired all the time. But then that's a phase, because if you wanted to do something, I think that you have to obsess about it. I don't think that we can. It's a choice. You can either be balanced, but that's a compromise that you'd have to make. And that compromise could be, you know, reaching that one goal that you want to achieve, which would require obsession and time. But going back to what you said about we put a lot in our work and our work isn't us. So there's this little fun exercise I did with a friend of mine, Ahmed Khanji. I hope he ends up listening to this. So we were talking about how we define ourselves, because I can't define. That's one of the things you asked me earlier, like, how do you want to be like titled? And I can't say I won't be able to say that I'm an architect. I can't say that I'm just an entrepreneur. I'm a collection of a lot of things. And it was the same for him as well. I mean, he's a physiotherapist, but he was really into wellness and culture and a lot of other things. So we had this little exercise. We were meeting a group of people. And obviously, one of the first things when you meet people is they'd usually ask, what do you do?
Yeah.
And it always goes back to career. And career should only be a portion of who we are. We are so many other things. So I remember one of us said, you know, how long is it going to take until we break? And we kind of say, oh, this is what I do, you know? So it was really tapping into all of the other things that we're interested in. And I think it's an exercise we should really keep doing.
Oh, this is good.
Because we're not defined. I mean, you know, we had a participant yesterday. She was an architect, but she was into fencing as well. And that was a huge thing. I would love to hear about the fencing more than the architecture part.
No, because she's, I know her, so she's beautifully educating and nurturing tons of youngsters.
Yeah.
Which is such a great thing to do.
So finding balance, I think balance is an equation that we will have to set for ourselves. Am I balanced? I can't say that I'm balanced. Do I have it right? God, no. Like, sometimes I think, like, why did I even have to juggle so many things? And I think that it's just, that's what energizes me.
Yeah.
And a lot of that inspiration and groundedness, I think, comes from the little moments that you were talking about.
Yeah. The simple ones.
The simple ones, because that feeds into us, but we're rushing all the time.
Yeah.
That we escape these things. I mean, for me, it's looking up at the moon. I mean, it was a full moon yesterday, if I'm not mistaken.
It was beautiful.
And every time I look at the moon, honestly, like a moon in the sunset, like a child, like I'm always like, oh my God. You know, it's like the first time I've seen the moon. And for me, that's like, it's perfect that I would pause and just take a look at something so beautiful that we take for granted. And that's enough for me because I know that I'm present and I'm aware. And that's enough.
Our time is almost up and we have to see each other again. So many things to talk about. I just want to ask, it's a dull question of plans, but because this is so specific and, you know, people will listen and then they might wonder, what's next for Sara? Really, what is next? Even if it's just a simple thing.
Growth. I think for me, next growth, and that's on a self-development front, but also on like the three main things that I'm doing now. I'd really want to grow them and establish them because I've reached a point where I can't be, going back to balance, I can't be fully involved in everything and completely hands-on. So I think it's growth for that. And professionally, and making sure that I'm stay curious.
Thank you so much, Sara.
Thank you, Xenia. This was actually wonderful. I was just like getting started.
Yes, I know. This is the kind of conversations that energize us and give us so many ideas. And we could talk for a long, long time. But this is why we'll find a spot and time to see each other again.
I'm sure we will.
Thank you again for taking time to be part of Culture Corner.
Thank you so much.
See you soon.
Thank you.